which such active technologies were stored. But it took up only half the box. In the shock packing next to it rested a small lozenge of memory crystal, ringed on its thinner edge with org anchor and connection points. Jerusalem went on. During our last communication, Jack informed me of how Cormac accumulates people, weapons, random elements, pieces to utilize in any future battle against Skellor. He does not know how he will use them. All is contingent. He creates a protean counteragent to Skellor. Reaction being his forte, rather than the hard wiring of preparation. Yawn. Very well. The memory crystal matrix will fit into your stomach cavity, the one you used to carry ballot devices while undercover on Masada. You will place the crystal in there, where programmed nanofilament connection will commence. I don't need any more memory space. As you well understand, it is not for you. Loading will take place when you step out of the Skyden warp on Ruby Eye. You know, I have the right to refuse this. I would rather Cormac saw a familiar face and had no reason for suspicion. What is your game? I am providing Cormac with one more piece in his game, one he will know nothing about and cannot reveal to Skellor in any way, the one that might kill Skellor should all else fail. Fethan reached down and ran his finger down the stick seam of his shirt. Internally, he instructed disconnections. The pilot looked round just in time to see Fethan split his stomach as if he had just given himself a caesarean to reveal a wet, red cavity. Don't worry, it doesn't hurt. The pilot faced forwards again and said nothing. Fethan pulled the crystal out of its padding, pushed it inside himself until it rested against his cerebral spine, then up until it touched just below his chest case, which contained most of his essential being. Immediately he felt the org anchors and other connections engaging and withdrew his hand. Little flickers, like those experienced by someone about to experience a migraine, jagged across his vision. He smelt something, at once familiar and mysterious. There came the sound of a distant shouting crowd, muttering close.
What will I be carrying? He asked.
A part of me that has long experience of searching virtual networks and dealing with problems there. Many AIs carry copies of it. Ruby Eye is one of them. When, some hours later, Fethan stepped from the Runcible on Ruby Eye and felt the uploading link connecting, he said aloud,
I am Legion.
Then, internally,
I am also a fucking booby trap.
Soon a copy of the killer program which Ruby Eye had sent against Skellor was straining at its leash inside him. Retroact 11. Using gritty sand and seawater, Balch cleaned his hands of clotted blood. He then dropped the bag into the shallow brine and one by one took out the etched sapphires, cleaned them, and transferred them to a less fouled container.
Did you get them all? Arion asked.
Balch looked up. 4.5 million. The last few went down into his lungs, and that's what killed him. Arion nodded and turned back to watch his men filing down, loaded with loot, from Alston's residence. He was grabbing as much as he could, but would also leave much behind. Others of his men, having dropped off their loads in the boat's hold, were returning to the house, dragging corpses up with them. Those corpses closest to the shore had gone into the sea, and pearl crab activity had consequently increased.
"Took him a while to die," Balch added. "He'd emptied his bowels and managed to tear off most of his fingernails in the struggle. The golem also managed to smash most of his teeth as it fed the sapphires inside him."
Arion wondered just what had made the golem kill the man like that. The instruction had been a simple, "Kill Alston and any who try to prevent you doing so." There had been nothing about making the man eat his own money, nothing about piling up the dead into tangled sculptures, and nothing about methodically killing every other human on this island. Accessing the control module through his org, he still got "Objective achieved," a grid reference showing the golem's location as unchanged, and some jumbled imagery of shapes moving about in the void. It made no sense.
"Angel,"
Peltus stepped over to his sister as she returned with the looters, "is there anything else worth grabbing?"
"Plenty," said Angelina, "but maybe it would be best to get out of here before some polity sat eye takes a close look."
Arion nodded.
"True. Are the charges set?"
"Ready to burn."
Angelina spat over the ignition code from her org to Arion's.
"Then all that remains is for us to collect Mr. Crane," he said.
Angelina stared at him as if he were quite insane. His people, bringing their load to the boat, stopped to hear what her response might be.
"Let's just leave him where he is," she suggested.
Arion shook his head.
"A subverted and upgraded Golem 25. Leave it here with the corpses of Jesus knows how many of its victims. And believe me, they would find those bodies."
He looked around at the watching men.
"We're not ready for the kind of attention that would attract. You think the polity agents and monitors crawling around Chain 3 are too many now? If they found this, we wouldn't be able to move for them. They'd trace every scrap of DNA on this island and mind-ream everyone involved, innocent or otherwise. You really want that?"
There came a general muttering of dissent. Arion went on.
"So we collect Mr. Crane and take him home with us."
When the last of the men had returned, Arion sent out the code and observed the growing glow from the centre and other points of the island as each slow-burning thermoxite charge ignited. Alston's house was burning. Those grotesque sculptures were burning. But still, there would be a great deal of evidence of massacre here. Arion just wanted to disguise precisely how Alston and his people had died. As they took the boat around to the other side of the island, flames were belching tens of metres into the sky. Mr. Crane came meekly when called, a demon constrained by a spell, and stood utterly still while Balch extended a hose from the boat to wash the golem down. Then Crane went down into the hold.
"I hope you're not having second thoughts," Angelina said.
"Oh, no," said Arion. "We put him away."
Angelina reached out and gripped his shoulder.
"Arion, this is no defeat. We just regroup and move on. There's that new arms supplier who says he can provide us with some serious hardware, the kind on which you only have to pull a trigger."
Arion turned to her.
The silver-haired guy? The one you want to fuck?
That's him, Angelina replied. We don't need polity killing machines. Perhaps trying not to think about the horror they had just seen, Arian said,
Yes, he seems the kind of person we need. Perhaps through him things will change, get better.
They did, but for whom, it was a matter of perspective. A day later, they walked Crane down a stairway concealed below a statue of Arian's father. In the dank room at the bottom, the firm instruction to sit down was repeated and enforced in 5-second cycles. Crane sat on the single chair and did not see where Arian placed the module. Not that he could subvert the order to sit within 5 seconds, nor had a mind to. Arian and his sister backed out of the door, followed by the two men bearing mini-grenade launchers. The door was locked and bolted, and sealed and hidden. Mr. Crane adjusted his vision to infrared, and in mouldering darkness sat watching the door. Retroact ending. Darkness, filled with a grid of light, four-dimensional in reality and memory, two-dimensional in representation. The icons shifting in random but ever firmer pattern, some holding their place for a while, then moving on when combinations of the other pieces made that place untenable. A blue acorn turning in void, while a small rubber dog looks on in amusement. Blood and death across an endless virtual plane. Crane, brass hands clean of gore, moves a piece, finds a connection. Then an infinity of possibilities dissolves, and sanity takes one step closer. Retroact ends. In some of the time that anyone else would have spent in cold sleep, Skellor hardened and refined the structures inside him, tracked down errors and erased them, collated and organized the information stored in the crystal part of his mind, and discarded all he considered irrelevant. But more frequently now he was coming across anomalies growing in his Jane substructure. It was doing something, changing in a furtive manner, diverting resources to create nodes within its framework. Allowing one of these to develop for a little while, Skellor encountered multiple layers of complexity, internally referenced, beginning to attain physical independence, almost like a tumour. He probed and he tested, and he studied, but the object defied analysis. In the end, he had to burn it inside himself. And as he destroyed it, he felt a murmur of rebellion from the rest of the substructure.
You will have answers for me, dragon, he said to the grey of U-space.
From behind came the clink, clink of small sounds as Mr. Crane repositioned his toys. Skellor expelled smoke from his mouth and ignored those sounds as he repaired the damage the burn had inflicted. From his wrist he extruded a tentacle, which writhed through the air, groped across the console before him, and found a universal PowerPoint. With his other hand, he picked up a pack of food concentrate from the container open beside him and began to eat the lot without unwrapping it.
You know about this, Jane, and I wonder if it was the reason for your reluctance to return to your masters, said Skellor when he had consumed the concentrate.
With repairs made,
and all the collation, organisation and deletion up to date, he dropped himself to a low ebb, similar to sleep, and closed his eyes for the memory of it. Mr. Crane wore out a blue acorn and wore grooves into the metal deck with his piece of thermocrystal carbon. Time passed. It does. Eventually lights flickered on the console, and one amber light came on and stayed on. Skeller opened his eyes, nodded his head once, and the vulture rose out of underspace into the actinic light of a close sun, released a cloud of miniature detectors and U-space transceivers, then turned automatically into an arc that would take it to pre-programmed coordinates. Skeller felt some satisfaction in this, then more when his instruments detected similar devices beaming their reams of data down towards the planet the vulture approached. All satisfaction fled when he turned his attention inwards and detected another of those nodes growing inside himself. He bellowed, his mouth full of fire. He breathed smoke and red-hot patches showed in the tough material of his chest. And as he performed this cautery, the grub-like ship he occupied descended from the night sky, leaving a vapour trail like a deletion across the distant swirls of interstellar dust and nascent stars. "You will have damned answers," he told the vista that opened out to him. The vulture decelerated over mountain chains, deserts and dusty plateau. Telescoping compound eyes briefly noted the ship's passage, dismissed this object as inedible and irrelevant, and returned to the lifetime pursuit of consumption, or the avoiding of it. Other eyes, blue sapphires, positioned in the mouths of pseudopod cobra heads, made the same observation but a different assessment, and their long, snakish necks withdrew into the ground. The ship overflew a city, gleaming with light, and was observed there by Galilean metalliers who had been looking for such a thing for a long time, and in that city great excitement ensued. It planed over the sand towers and ahead. In his virtual vision, Skellor could see his final destination, a vast multicoloured point, the nexus of many streams of information. It was a microsecond before he realised that one of those streams was issuing from the vulture itself. "What the hell?" he asked, his speech infinitely slower than the probe he sent into the vulture's systems. "Well, I can't say it's been fun, but I'm out of here." Skeller tried to find some link from that message to whatever it was that skulked in the systems of this little ship. Then he realized what it must be. "I killed you!" "Wrong, bozo. Happy landings." The Vulture AI must have struck a deal with Dragon, for Dragon had formed a wideband link down which the AI was transmitting herself. Skellor sent kill programs in, but they found only emptiness, the AI sliding to a different location in silicon vastness as it continued escaping like water draining down a plug hole. Skeller withdrew. The AI would not have communicated without the sure knowledge that it could escape him. "Happy landings." Just as that parting shot fully impinged, the side thrusters of the vulture came on at full power. Then the fusion engine attempted ignition, with half its injectors shut down, and blew one side out of its chamber. Fire cut a hole through the back of the ship, severing vital power ducts to rear grav motors, and, spiralling and tumbling, the vulture fell towards the sand towers.
In less than a second, Skeller regained control of the Vulture systems, shut off the side thrusters, and turned on the extinguishers in the back section of the ship. But half the AG was gone, and the ship out of control. Making rapid calculations, Skeller input a program to the thrusters. They began firing, seemingly at random, but over long seconds, the effects became evident. The ship stopped tumbling. Then its corkscrewing course straightened, just in time for it to strike the side of a butte and glance off in an explosion of sand and fire. Directly ahead now, there was nothing but a head-on smash into sandstone. 20 degrees to the right lay the only viable option, a canyon about a half kilometre long. More calculation. Thruster fire flipping the Vulture onto its back. Secondary explosion of the fusion engine blowing the other half of its chamber. Chopping through the side of a butte, which slowly collapsed behind it, the Vulture entered the canyon upside down. Skeller turned it on thrusters, also using forward thrusters and what grav planing he could manage to slow the ship. At the last moment, the ship turned. It hit side on, throwing up a wave of dust and sand, churning up a trail a quarter of a kilometre long. Travelling at 200 kilometres an hour, it hammered bottom first into the buttes at the end of the canyon, but rather than be buried in an avalanche of sandstone, remained where it was, as the entire butte collapsed away from the ship like a felled tree. The airlock opened onto the acrid taste of salty dust, and Skellor climbed out to stand on the side of the Vulture. He looked about, then spat ash onto the hot metal he stood upon. Behind him, Crane hauled himself out and awaited instruction. The dust and the heat generated by the impact drew attention from all around. Nearby, the 2-metre-long second-stage Sleer had seen it all, and registered only prey. Skellor did not see the beast. Concentrating on his virtual vision of the tight-beamed lines of communication to and from Dragon's location, he saw them all winking out like searchlights struck by enemy fire. From those transmitters built inside himself, he attempted to open a line of communication between himself and the alien entity. It was immediately blocked.
"So, you don't want to talk to me," murmured Skellor, walking down the curve of the hull and dropping the last few meters to the ground. He turned to watch Crane follow him, and thought to himself that such words might be bravado. He was now down on a primitive planet with his ship wrecked, while the one he had come to see was unprepared to communicate. And he had just learned he had been carrying a spy with him all the time. It seemed optimistic to hope that Vulture had not managed to get information out to the polity and its watchdog, ECS. So now, rather than go dragon hunting, Skellor realized he must make repairs and give himself the option of escape. He looked Crane up and down.
"I think I will have to send an envoy, though diplomacy is not exactly your forte."
As Mr. Crane brushed dust from his coat, Skellor observed the few rips there repairing themselves. Now, while the golem straightened his hat, Skellor remembered, from recordings found on the Occam razor, how Dragon had named Jane technology the enemy, and, upon learning of its presence aboard that ship, had been eager to depart.
"Perhaps Dragon won't perceive you as so much of a threat as myself if you are only a machine."
He stepped forwards and reached out to press his hand against Crane's chest. Crane did nothing more than blink his black eyes, then tilt his head to look down at the hand. Skellor connected to the mycelium he had installed inside the golem and began to look very closely at what it had wrought underneath that brass skin. Certainly, some sections of this mycelium were inaccessible to Skellor, just as they had been in the separatist woman, Afrin, on the Occam Razor. Also, it had made unexpected changes inside the golem that had vastly improved the efficiency of his workings. But the mycelium was inferior, a simple analogue of what lived in Skellor, what he was, in fact, and was as vulnerable to him as a spider web is to flame. Skellor encompassed all its transformations and made provision for them in the nanocyte counteragent he had created, like a mirror image, the moment he resurrected Mr. Crane. And the palm of his hand grew warm as that agent entered the brass killing machine. Skellor stepped back and watched on many levels. The mycelium inside Crane began dissolving at the point of contact, and that dissolution spread. Microscopic and macroscopic fibers withered. Memory storage nodes no larger than a grain of salt collapsed to dust. Independent nanomachines designed and created by the mycelium for specific purposes, the nanocytes, were hunted and brought down like wildebeest by a pack of hyenas. Then, when nothing but the hyenas remained, they too began to disintegrate. And Skellor's vision then became only external. If he had expected any dramatic reaction from the obdurate golem, he was disappointed. Crane stood there as unchanged as a prehistoric monument, until he raised his head. For a moment, Skellor thought he read petulance in that metal face, but surely that was unlikely. "Dragon," Skellor said, "no doubt you'll decode this from the fragmented mind of this golem. I have not come to attack you, but to learn from you. When you are ready, please open a link with me, and I will communicate only verbally. I have much to gain from you, and you have much to gain from me." Skellor turned, sending the signal through the primitive control module Arian Pelter had used to get Crane on his way. The second stage Sleer, sneaking up through the dust cloud, he had detected some time earlier, and as a footnote to the message, he instructed Crane to deal with that. Out of settling dust, the Sleer came scuttling and sliding, its mouth cutlery rubbing together with a sound like an automatic hacksaw, with jets of lubricating fluid spraying from glands positioned beside its mouth. Skellor observed the creature analytically, then moved aside. Crane stepped forward and brought his boot down, hard. The Sleer, its head crushed to pulp, rattled its legs against the ground and expired with a sound like an unknotted balloon.
"Interesting place," said Skellor, turning back to the vulture.
Without looking round, Crane moved off. Chapter 11. The Quiet War. This is often how the AI takeover is described, and even using war seems overly dramatic. It was more a slow usurpation of human political and military power while humans were busy using that power against each other. It wasn't even very stealthy. Analogies have been drawn with someone moving a gun out of the reach of a lunatic while that person is ranting and bellowing at someone else. And so it was. AIs, long used in the many corporate, national and religious conflicts, took over all communication networks and the computer control of weapons systems. Most importantly, they already controlled the enclosed human environments scattered throughout the solar system. Also establishing themselves as corporate entities, they soon accrued vast wealth with which to employ human mercenary armies. National leaders in the solar system, ordering this launch or that attack, found their orders either just did not arrive or caused nil response. Those same people, ordering the destruction of the AIs, found themselves weaponless in environments utterly out of their control and up against superior forces and, on the whole, public opinion. It had not taken the general population, for whom it was a long-established tradition to look upon their human leaders with contempt, very long to realize that the AIs were better at running everything. And it is very difficult to motivate people to revolution when they are extremely comfortable and well off. From Quince Guide, compiled by humans. The asteroid, with the bridge pod now separate, Jerusalem scoured down to the molecular level. Keeping it in quarantine had become a pointless exercise, and the object only a hindrance until now. The Jerusalem surfaced from U-space like an iron moon coming out of shadow, blood red in the light of the dwarf star. This little-acknowledged system was busy now, and all around ships were appearing with similar alacrity to the Jerusalem, but they were closing in on the research station, Ruby Eye, while the big research vessel itself fell into orbit around the red dwarf. Here, the doors to one of its massive holds opened and the great ship decelerated. Free from restraint now, the asteroid from the belt proximate to Elysium slid smoothly out into space. The Jerusalem then turned, leaving the great rock hovering in black silhouette over the sun, revolving gently as it took the course of its slow orbit. Something then spat from the Jerusalem, a chain glass sphere, 2 meters in diameter, coin-shaped debonders attached to its poles. It headed straight towards the asteroid, and then, 10 meters from impact, the debonders found the ends of the long silicate molecules making up the glass and set them unravelling. The sphere became opaque, fuzzy, and when it hit the rocky surface, it disappeared in a cloud of white dust. What it contained, looking like the dirt-clogged root system of a tree, bounced once, seemed to shift as it came down again, and stuck. As the asteroid turned into the harsh heat and light of the sun, the object on its surface stretched as if waking from a long sleep, and began to grow. They halted out of sight of the mineralier encampment, and Anderson began to ready his equipment. Watching the knight assembling his lance, Turgel wondered if he himself might have done better to stay behind. He guessed it was all about the level of damage a weapon could inflict. Bullets from Anderson's fusile might just penetrate hard carapace, but were just as likely to bounce off.
"Not a profession I'd choose," said Anderson, gesturing back to the encampment with his thumb.
"Why?" asked Turgel, eyeing the lance.
"Dangerous job now, what with all the quakes."
Turgle choked back his laughter. When he was finally able to speak, he asked,
"Why don't you use your carbine? On the automatic setting, it should do enough damage."
"But would you bet your life on that?"
Anderson asked.
"I want to at least bring down a second stager with it before countenancing something like this."
The lance screwed together in four sections, each a meter long. Turgle studied the framework Anderson had erected beside his saddle on Bonehead's back. The frame's feet mated into socket plates that had been both glued and riveted into place, and then turned his attention to the final section of lance Anderson picked up.
"Nasty," he said.
"Obviously the point is for penetration," said the knight, running a sharpening stone along the edges of the 10-centimeter triangular section point. "These blade hooks run in a spiral."
He now began sharpening the forward and outer edges of the blades, spiraling back along the rest of the section from its point. From the rear of each of these axe-head pieces of steel protruded sharp barbs.
As it penetrates, the lance screws itself into the creature, right down into its rear breeding segment. What finally kills it is when it tries to pull away.
"The barbs rip out its insides," Turgle observed.
"But surely the point might glance off its armor."
"Not if you hit it in the mouth," Anderson explained.
He screwed the final section into place and picked up the lance in one hand.
"Here."
He held it out to Turgle, who took it in both hands, then, upon discovering how light it was, held it in one hand only.
"Plaited fibers from the stalks of amanus plants, bonded in epoxy," Anderson explained. "Very light, and stronger than any wood. The metalliers manufacture some alloys just as light, but they don't have the same strength."
"And if it breaks?" Turgle asked.
"It broke only once, at one of the screw points, but by then most of it was inside the third stager I'd impaled. The creature managed to saw off the stub protruding from its mouth as it died. It didn't attack again, just stood there trying to figure out what was wrong with itself. Sliers are not as bright as sand hogs."
Anderson took the lance back and, with it resting across his shoulder, climbed up onto Bonehead's back. Once seated, he put the lance down with its eyed butt dropping over an iron pin and resting back against a pad in the framework, its weight supported by rests protruding ahead of him. His carbine now rested in a makeshift holster on the opposite side of his saddle from his fusil. While Anderson was doing up his lap straps, Bonehead turned on his crawler limbs to face down the canyon to which Chandle had directed them, then rose up onto his hind limbs.
"You don't have to come," said Anderson,
as Turgle stepped up onto stone. Plumping himself in his saddle, Turgle replied,
"I know. Don't think I didn't consider staying back there, but I'd never forgive myself for not seeing this."
Anderson nodded, picked up his goad, and tapped it against the shell extending in front of him. The hog reluctantly folded its sensory head out and up, opened out its eye palps to observe him for a second, before swiveling them forwards as it set out. Turgle glanced at the obvious trail they were following. Anderson had already told him the third stager would not be far away, as they did not require wide territories in which to find something to eat. Within an hour, they came upon the remains of one of its meals.
"Sand gulper,"
Turgle observed as they passed the scattering of carapace. Little enough remained for identification of the creature, though Turgle did recognize the chitinous shovel it used to scoop up the sand it passed through its throat sieves and the big, flat forefeet it used for digging. The predator had sawn all the main sections of carapace into pieces no larger than a man's torso, so that it could munch out every soft part with ease. As far as Turgle was concerned, even creatures like this were best avoided, yet what they were going after just ate them up. It occurred to him that his education first as a gully trader's child and a mineralier, then as a traveller and a thief, had been sadly lacking. That had only concerned the dangers he might face travelling between the settled areas in the more heavily populated human areas of Kull. Until now, the greatest alien danger had been from what he had known as adult Sleers, and he'd thought little of any other creatures his parents had mentioned.
"Ah, this might make things a little more interesting," said Anderson abruptly, breaking Turgle's introspection.
Cold winds whipped down the canyon, hazing the air with sand. Turgle looked up to their right, where Anderson was pointing. Over the buttes, a line of darkness was rising, boiling along its edge.
"Shouldn't we turn back?" Turgle asked. "You don't want to be facing this thing in a downpour." "A little late for that."
The night now pointed ahead and to their left. Turgle felt something tighten in the pit of his stomach. The third stager was black against a vertical sandstone cliff, swinging its awful head from side to side, its huge pincers gleaming sharp as obsidian, and its jointed carapace saws scrabbling at the stone, sending pieces of it tumbling down the face of the butte. Turgle suddenly realized that his nice new handgun, his crossbow and his punch axe were woefully inadequate should this monster get past the night. He watched it move along, parallel to the ground, its antlers coiling in and out, then abruptly turn and come, half falling, half running, down the sandstone face. It landed on its belly in a cloud of dust, came up high, with its legs at full extension, and curled its tail segments up over its head, its ovipositor drill visibly revolving.
"Oh, Bonehead, let's take this fucker!"
Anderson lifted his lance from its rests and its rear peg and directed it ahead between his sandhog's raised eye palps. Bonehead folded out its tailplate as a counterbalance and broke into a loping run. Turgle did not need to tap his goad behind Stone's head to make it halt. It had already done so, and, making small bubbling sounds, was beginning to back up. In that moment, Turgle doubted the sanity of the night. Anyone who looked for this sort of action had to be five legs short of a desert ride. It also occurred to him that anyone thinking of robbing such a man was of questionable sanity too. Just then, something clattered against Stone's carapace, leaving a chalky smear, then again and again. Hailstones the size of eyeballs were soon rattling and smacking down, bouncing down the faces of the buttes, shattering on exposed rocks. Turgle pulled the chinstrap down from his hat and secured it, took his chitin-armoured gauntlets from his belt and pulled them on. He did not halt Stone as it withdrew its sensory head and continued retreating.
"Ho! Ho!"
Anderson was bouncing up and down in his saddle as if this might make Bonehead go faster. The old sandhog was kicking up clouds of dust as it accelerated, its feeding head now extruding underneath its sensory head and clunking into place. The monstrous Sleer accelerated also, oblivious to the white rain shattering on its own carapace. It made no sound, no hissing challenge, just opened out its pincers wide enough to encompass three men and levelled its tail.
Lunatic,
Turgle whispered. But he saw that, despite any unevenness in the ground or in Bonehead's gait, the lance remained utterly level and true. Then they struck. The lance went perfectly between pincers and saws. The point passed into the creature's gape without touching the sides, the barbed blades smashing one of its mandibles. In it went, and Turgle saw Anderson briefly relax his grip to allow the lance to spin, its butt pushed back against the pad, the spiraling blade screwing it inside the attacking monster. The impact put Bonehead down on his tailplate and lifted the sleer off the ground, its tail cracking up and down. Coming down, it now whipped its head from side to side, trying to free itself as Anderson re-engaged the eye butt at the back of his lance. Then, through the hailstorm, Turgle heard the knight shouting at Bonehead and saw the old hog slowly and methodically start backing up, both its own heads now safely stowed. The sleer was fighting to pull away as well. Then, abruptly, something gave. The lance tore out a ragged mess of the creature's guts and vital organs and dragged them through the sand. The sleer froze where it was, its pincers opening and closing as yellow ichor dribbled from its mouth. It began quivering, and its head abruptly bowed until its pincers jammed against the ground. Then it became utterly still.
I didn't get it all out, Anderson's voice broke through Turgle's horrified fascination. But don't worry, it should be dead.
Turgle jerked, coming out of a fugue.
Are you sure?
He stared at the knight as hailstones played a tattoo on the older man's armour.
I think so.
Anderson held up the lance with its tatters of offal hanging from the barbs and peered at it dubiously.
See that grey stringy stuff? Well, that's most of its brain.
An anatomy lesson now, muttered Turgle.
Certainly, the knight told him. And the pink, knobbly bits are from its lateral lungs, and that long, dangly bit is part of what served the function of kidneys for it.
Turgle gestured to their surroundings, rapidly being buried under a layer of hailstones.
Perhaps we should save this discussion until after we've erected one of our shelters.
Anderson looked around.
Oh, yes, he said. I see what you mean.
Through one of the wide viewing windows, Fethon watched the Theta-class attack ship negotiating its way in through the gathering crowd, then turned to present its side to the docking tower. He knew the name of this ship, not because it was the mythical name for a hangman, but because of rumours of vicious conflicts, not involving humans, in areas of the line of polity where a threat had become evident, that could only be dealt with by heavy AI intervention. This long, flat ship, with its torpedo-shaped weapons nacelles, was bloody red, and seemed as menacing in appearance as he knew it to be in fact. But even this ship was negligible in comparison to some of the other things he had seen out there. Turning from the window, Fethon moved back to his table, and once again took up his glass of brandy. It tasted as good to him as always, though the liquor, rather than being digested as it had been when he was fully human, was directly utilized by a hydrocarbon-based power supply that complemented the micropiles powering his body. Initiating an internal program, he allowed himself a certain degree of intoxication while observing his surroundings. The only sign, here inside, of the ECS police action that had taken place was a line of pulse gun burns across the opposite wall, above a bar where many people were locked in excited and animated conversation. Ruby Eye had informed him that those members of the DracoCorp network not in a security area were in a hospital wing, and none of the latter would be going anywhere for a while. Apparently, all their orgs had died on them, and, as well as the withdrawal from that, they were suffering the psychological trauma of having been subjected to a level of agony few humans could have survived had its cause been physical. And now, most of them were in fugue. The ones in the security area were only those few who had been hit by riot guns or some other form of stunner, and who had been unconscious when Skellor transmitted his horrible sensory recording. Now ECS was responding in a big way to the threat that bastard represented. Like the people at the bar, other residents of the station were mingling with rubbernecking gregariousness, as people often do during dramatic events. Fethan noted various dapts conversing with standard format humans and was unsurprised that some new versions had appeared during the time he had been away from the polity. He observed one woman drawing on a long cigar and then blowing smoke out of her gill slits, and though he had seen sea dapts before, he'd never actually seen a mermaid. This woman rested coiled on a plate which was supported on an ornate pedestal, like some exotic dish brought out from the nearby restaurant, an establishment he had already seen serving authentic trilobite thermidor. Standing by a vending machine to the left of the bar were three exceptionally tall people, each of whom possessed metallic skin, wore thick goggles, and owned a third, smaller arm on the right-hand side, its supporting musculature making them look decidedly lopsided. Fethan couldn't work out what their adaptation might be for. He smiled when he saw an outlinker, clad in an exoskeleton, walking warily across this crowded area, and he wondered what relation that woman might be to Apis Coolant. Cormac and Gant, when they, too, stepped into the open area and scanned around, seemed utterly unremarkable in comparison to these exotic types, which went to show that appearance wasn't everything. Fethan raised a hand and sent a signal via his internal comlink to Gant. The golem touched Cormac's shoulder and pointed Fethan out. Then the two walked over to him. As they approached, Fethan studied them both. Brejoy Gant wore the same outward appearance he had possessed as a human being. Utterly bald, skin carrying a slightly purplish tint, a thick-set bruiser who looked capable of tearing off people's arms long before he had actually gained that ability. At a distance, Ian Cormac wore the same appearance as the bulk of humanity, with his olive skin, average height, and averagely muscled body. His silverish hair was also favoured by many, who wanted to retain some sign that they were ageing, so there was nothing odd about that either. Close to, however, you started to see something else. His sharp, striking features displayed a depth of character that seemed in utter contrast to the dead flatness of his grey eyes. This, Fethan understood, was a man who could kill without compunction or guilt in the service of his own conception of right and wrong. He also contained a capacity for great love, and it was full, and his mistress was the polity. "Hello, Fethan," said Gant. Fethan clasped the golem's hand, remembering the both of them running away from hooders and gabbleducks on Masada, and how much fun that had been. Releasing his grip, Fethan turned to Cormac.
"What did Ruby Eye tell you?"
"To come here, where it would come to meet me. Nothing was said about you being here, and not a lot about what's going on outside. Do you represent the AI?"
"No. I'm here with the counter-agent, that bugger Jerusalem developed. It apparently worked on a Selis Mika.
Fethan paused.
You know she's aboard the Jerusalem.
He waved a hand vaguely towards the ceiling. Yes, I am aware of that, Cormac replied succinctly. Wondering at the man's abrupt tone, Fethan went on,
It was also working on Apis Coolant when I left, and I've since heard he's up and grumping about. It'll next be used on Eldine after her mycelium has been removed, which is happening right now.
A further reason for me to be surprised at your presence here. I know you'd feel some responsibility for the girl. I thought you'd want to be at her side, said Cormac, following Gant's lead by pulling out a chair and sitting down.
Comes a time they grow up and go their own way. She has Apis now, and might resent me hanging around. Anyway, what other chances would I have to get aboard the Jack Ketch?
Fethan folded his arms over his chest and wondered if he might have done so defensively to further conceal the big lump of intelligent crystal sitting inside his torso.
Why would you want that? Gant grinned.
Like you, I want to be where the action is, and it's getting real boring on Masada at the moment.
Turning to Cormac, Fethan continued,
Any objections?
None at all, said Cormac. Then he turned as a vendor tray floated over to their table and hovered attentively, three brandy goblets on its upper surface. Fethan supposed Gant must have used his internal radio to order the round of drinks from the metal skin working the bar, but noting the golem's amused surprise, he narrowed his eyes and studied Cormac.
You gridlinked again?
He asked. Yes, so it would seem. Cormac took the three brandies off the tray and placed them on the table. The tray, its little beady eyes watching from underneath, seemed disinclined to move off again. Cormac merely turned and stared at it. The two eyes blinked, and the tray shot away as fast as it could.
From what Gant and Thorn told me, I thought you no longer wanted that option, Fethan said.
Cormac fixed his gaze on Fethan, and the old cyborg understood how the vending tray had felt. It's not a matter of choice. I managed to turn it on again myself, though not intentionally, and now it seems the only way to turn it off permanently is to have it totally removed from my head. He turned aside and stared over towards the mermaid on her platter. However, having somehow gained greater ability in the use of this link, I can often see through AI subterfuge and recognize some of the silly games they play to stop themselves getting bored. He continued to stare at the mermaid. She started to fidget, glanced over, then sighed. A plate rose up on AG, the pedestal telescoping up inside it, and she floated over.
Ruby eye, said Cormac.
How did you do that? Said this avatar of the station AI, as the plate once again extended its pedestal.
I can access levels that perhaps you would rather I did not, he gestured to the viewing window, though I still haven't plumbed what's going on out there. So tell me, the kill program that nearly got Skella, where did it come from? Because I know it certainly wasn't yours.
Fethan looked to Gant, who shrugged resignedly and sat back in his chair, sipping his brandy. Fethan took up his new glass and did the same, deciding that if things didn't become clear, he could always ask later, aboard the Jack Ketch. It was one of many propagated by the Jerusalem AI to track down dragon spheres. It is not just a killer program, just as you are not merely a killer, Ruby Eye replied. Fethan coughed and spluttered. Artificial body or not, it wasn't a good idea to try breathing brandy. Shooting him an odd glance, Cormac asked Ruby Eye, And where is it now?
Returned to its creator.
Fethan put his glass to one side and watched Cormac sit back, interlacing his fingers before his chin. He then extended his two forefingers, pressed together, to the tip of his nose, and frowned. "I need to know where Skellor went," he said. "The Dracocorp orgs, either owned by or owning people here, can be trawled for information. Even though it missed grabbing the coordinates it was waiting for, that program should be here, running in you, so that I can question it." "There is no need," said Ruby Eye, drawing on her cigar. "We received sufficient information to narrow the area of search to 6 planetary systems. A little ship's AI, called Vulture, even on the edge of extinction, managed to leave a message."
"Why wasn't this sent to me?"
"It was only recently discovered, and it was felt that the benefits gained for Patron Thorn by your obtaining the nanobots outweighed any loss of time in your pursuit of Skellor. Also, it was deemed advisable for you to see what is happening here." Scattering ash across the table, Ruby Eye waved her cigar at the viewing window. Fethan wondered if his own grin looked too fixed.
"And that is?" Cormac asked.
Ruby Eye delivered her explanation, which Fethan knew was the truth for a change, and Cormac offered no reply. The agent looked first at Fethan, then at Gant.
"Let's go," he said.
The white plain, stretching endlessly below blue cloud-scudded sky, was just the background against which to display their reality. Jack was there in his antique pinstriped suit and bowler hat, as phlegmatic as always on these occasions. The others were as they were. Reaper always fluxed in scale, so that sometimes he was just man-sized like the rest of them, and sometimes he towered against the blue sky, his scythe blade a glittering arc of steel capable of harvesting nations. His fuliginous robes ever seemed to be moving as if blown by some cliff-top breeze in some romantically wild location. Shadow waxed and waned in its cowl, never entirely revealing what it hooded. Sometimes there seemed a thin, pale face framed by white hair, with reddish nostrils and lips, and hard blue eyes. Other times a skull grinned out, blue flames burning in black eye sockets. The hands on the shaft of the scythe also seemed unable to make up their minds what